Garrett Ilsen here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. It's about to get real here because I'll be speaking to Ian Baker from the UK-British alternative rock band Jesus Jones. The band was formed in late 1988 and they continue to record and perform up until current times. Their track Right Here, Right Now was an international hit and was subsequently globally licensed for promotional and advertising campaigns. The single was also nominated for a Grammy Award at the 34th Annual Grammy Awards in 1991, as was its album, Doubt. They also achieved chart success with the songs Real, 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 International Bright Young Thing, and Info Freako. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Ian Baker from Jesus Jones. Where do we find you in the world? What's happening in your life and how are you doing?
I'm doing good at the moment. I'm just kind of focusing on the band, I guess, really, for 2023 after a couple of years where it's been intermittent, shall we say. You know, and I don't kind of do a vast amount of other stuff with my time and my life, really. I look after my kids. I have a couple of other little things that I do. So my work with the band is great. It's kind of not a career. It's like an intermittent hobby, you know, which is great because it means I can focus on it when I need to focus on it.
So now let's rewind all the way back to the very beginning. Let's tell them the Jesus Jones music journey and story.
Well, it's quite a long one, really. I mean, it's 35 years old, which is, I still find quite incredible. The band started in 1988, although it had been through a number of different iterations before it actually became Jesus Jones. So Mike Edwards, the singer and sort of, you know, musical driving force had tried to start a band and make a band work a few times. They've been called Camouflage. They've been called The Big Color. And for some reason, it just wasn't working, you know. And Mike had, you know, essentially he had a bunch of good songs. He had, you know, ideas, but things didn't really work. And the thing that made things work as Jesus Jones was really his understanding that he could start to sample things. So in the summer of 1988, you know, he was listening to, you know, hip hop and house music and dance music, as well as listening to rock music. And he started listening to dance music and thinks, well, this is kind of more exciting than the rock music that I'm doing at the moment. So why don't I take elements of this and turn it into something new? And at that point, Jesus Jones effectively was born. So Mike says, right, okay, we'll start all over again. We'll have a new name. We'll have a new identity. Well, maybe, you know, maybe a new bunch of songs. I've got a few ideas which I'm working on. And it was just a chance to start with a clean slate. And that was in July or August of 1988. And we started really playing gigs as a five piece in December. And mm-hmm. And the debut single was out in January 1989. So things happened really quickly. After that initial period of having the idea, it all kicked off really, really quickly. And then away we went.
Why the name Jesus Jones? Where does that come from?
Everybody wants a really cool story behind that. Everybody wants a really, a story that will make them go, oh, wow, so that's where it comes from. And the fact that the reason why we were called Jesus Jones is kind of boring. And it's down to the fact that we were called other things before that didn't really work. And everybody that's starting out in a band knows that one of the first things that people focus on as an unknown band or as a band trying out to make it is people really judge you on the quality of your name. They, you know, the amount of people, you know, you ring promoters and they'll say, you want a band? What do you call? Okay. All right, fair enough. And, you know, they judge you on the quality of your name, you know. Yeah. And that happens to bands that are starting out all the time. And because Jesus Jones had been two other bands before, and they weren't really getting places. There was a sense in, I think Mike and the rest of the band thought, well, maybe our previous names just sucked. You know, maybe if we're going to start this again with a new idea, we should start with a new name. So they became Jesus Jones. And the reason behind it is just really kind of dull and simple. You know, there were, I think the guitarist said to Mike, there's a few other bands out there with the word Jesus in the title. You're like Jesus and Mary Chain. Maybe you should,
Yes.
you know, have something with the word Jesus in. You know, maybe that would be kind of on trend and a bit kind of, you know, whatever. And I think somebody else suggested that they use the word Jesus Jones just because it's two words that begin with J and it sort of trips off your tongue. You know, it scans well. You know, Jesus
Yes.
Jones, dum da 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 da.
Yeah.
And you know, there's some alliteration going on there. It's short and it's snappy. So I hate to disappoint everybody out there, and say that it doesn't mean anything. There's no symbolism or mean. It was just like, can we try and find a cool name that maybe people will remember? And as soon as somebody said it, you know, one of the people in the band was like, well, yeah, okay, that's kind of, you know, it's easy to remember, it's snappy, let's go for it. And it worked, so we stuck with it.
And now you guys obviously knew that the new or Mike was had this idea for this new music of, you know, the dance and the rock and the different elements. Did you guys at the time think, cool, let's put it out there, it's going to do well? Yes, naturally, it's going to be successful. But did you re think that you'd be nominated for Grammy Awards?
No. Everybody always has that thing where you start a band and you think, yeah, this is it. The big time. Here we
Yeah.
come. But nobody ever really kind of thinks that that level of success will arrive. You know, when it does, it's just mind blowing. Having said that, you know, I remember when I joined the band, because they were a four piece for about a month. And then Mike played me the demos of Info Freako. He played me a demo of Info Freako, and I was like, that's amazing. You know, and the fully released version of Info is pretty much the same as the demo. So what you hear as that track is pretty much the same thing I heard as a demo. And when he played me that for the first time, or, you know, all right, you say, well, people don't think that they're ever going to be massively successful and famous, but I just knew that at that point, I knew it would work and I knew it would reach people and I knew people would love it because it was that good. Imagine if somebody gave you the winning lottery ticket
Yes.
numbers, you know, and you just like, this is a sure thing. I cannot miss. I can't lose. And I remember hearing that for the first time and think, and it's a strange feeling to hear that, you know. I was like, this is a sure thing. It can't fail because it's that good. You know, sometimes when people play their demos, it's okay and it needs work and you can see that it may develop or whatever. This was like a fully fledged idea that was, it was just there. And that was really exciting. So at that point, I knew it would work. You know, did I know that you'd end up getting a Grammy Award? No, hell no, no, but I knew it would work.
I remember as a young person at the time, I used to listen to, yeah, back in South Africa, we used to have the American charts every, I think it was a Saturday morning. And I was listening to your guys' songs, Who, Where, Why, International, Bright Young Thing, all those things, climbing the charts. And they were so hooky, an earworm, as it's called. And I remember loving them. But now, obviously, you guys have been carrying on over the time, over the period. Are you focusing on the stuff that you've released in the past, or are you guys going to be releasing any newer music?
Yeah, I mean, we do obviously focus on what we've done in the past because that's what people expect from us, and I get that. You know, that's absolutely fine. But we do new music too. We're currently working on new material. We've got a couple of songs that are all ready to go. We record them in different situations now. I mean, back in the day, you know, everybody's, you know, you all get together at the same point at the same time and you get to a studio and you record. And these days it doesn't quite happen like that. So, you know, Mike will do his parts and then he'll digitally send the files over and I can do backing vocals and Jerry can play his guitar. Jen has a MIDI drum kit so he can record the drums digitally, then they can be sent over, and everything's kind of remotely put together in a studio. So it's not quite the same process that it was, but it results in the same Jesus Jones material. So yeah, we're working on that. I would say though that the impetus for making new material is perhaps different than it used to be. When you're in a band, when we're in a band in the early 90s and the mid 90s, and when you're signed to a record label, there's external pressure to produce things. There's a guy in an office that's,
Yes.
hey, where's the Jesus Jones album, man? I
Yeah.
need another Jesus Jones album.
Yeah.
When you're signed to a record label, you're on that conveyor belt, and
Yes.
people are expecting you to produce stuff, which is good, because that acts as a creative impetus. But obviously, once we stopped working with record labels in that way, some of that impetus falls away. And we did spend, 10, 15 years when, because there's nobody telling you to write new material, you don't really write new material. So you perhaps lose focus or lose sight of what it is, of the situation that you need to be in to make music. And I think now we've realized you do it when and if you want to. If it's 10 days between new songs, fine. It's 10 months between new songs, fine. If it's 10 years between new songs, fine, because it's about what you want to do and when you want to do it. That's the important thing. So yeah, we work to our own schedule completely now.
You're on your own schedule now, but previously,
Yeah.
if you would have still been on that record label, on that conveyor belt, in inverted commas, do you feel that you
Yeah.
would have, that pressure would have allowed you to focus more and release more music regularly?
I don't know, actually. I mean, I think that, it's possible, but I think one of the interesting things about Jesus Jones is obviously is how that the pressure of being in a record company environment in the first part of our careers, how it affected us anyway. We did have a huge amount of success, and we had a large amount of success very early on. And by the time we got to album four, which is already, I'm not saying our career was over, but there'd been a kind of significant press backlash to what we did because we were working with so much technology, and people thought, oh, well, that's not cool anymore. And grunge had taken over, then Britpop, and those were two very different things to what we did, and we were just sort of not really in favor anymore. And so when the record company stopped working with us in about 97, 1998, it meant that period of success for us was over. And to get to my main point, I think I'd have to say that we learned so much from, as it were, being rejected by the music industry. We learned what it was to actually be ourselves. And I think it's helped us in the long run. I think it was better for us to do that. Yeah, if we'd have been on a label, we could have still been on the conveyor belt, and we could have still been recording music, but I don't think it perhaps would have been any good, because we would have, a lot of the passion would have gone out completely. Whereas because we were, as it were, rejected by the industry, and we had to kind of look back into ourselves, it made us rediscover who we were creatively. That's what's allowed us to continue writing and recording. If I think if we'd have been on that record company conveyor belt, I think we'd have sputtered along for another 2, 3 years, and then we'd have called it a day, and we'd have called it a day for good.
Okay.
And we said, that's it. As it was, getting off the conveyor belt was possibly the best decision we ever made. I say the best decision we ever made. Maybe it was made for us,
Yes.
but you know what I mean? It
Yeah,
was
yeah,
made
yeah, yeah.
for us,
Yeah.
but I think we found a way of making that decision, not somebody else's, but finding our own way through that decision, which is really important.
And these days, there's so many artists, independent artists that are not on record labels, just flying up the
Yeah.
charts and releasing music. You guys have been doing it for the longest time. So you can give courses to the new up and coming guys, saying, guys, this ain't good.
I think also, I mean, I think technology plays a large part in that because, you know, when we started doing things, we were a rock band using computers to make music, and we were kind of evangelizing that way of doing things. And by the time it got to Perverse, which is 1993, a lot of the press was saying, you know, we got a significant amount of flack for using technology. And they, you know, the idea was that, well, that can't be real music. You can't be a real, authentic musician making music if you're using computers. And if you're using computers, then if you're using technology, then it must be techno music you're making. You can't be making rock music. You must be making techno music. And to deal with those two points, I mean, I think fairly obviously, you know, they said, well, you can't be a real musician to do it, you know, using technology. That's insane. You know, now I'd say literally 95% of all musicians make their music that way, you know? And then the other argument, which was that they used to say, well, you're using computers, you're using technology, you must be making just techno or dance music. I don't get that. I mean, these days, it doesn't matter who you are. You can be a folk musician who just performs with an acoustic guitar using found sounds or just you and a microphone, and you can make that music, that kind of organic folk music. You can make that music using exactly the same technology that you would make dance music or house music or whatever. Just because it's technology, I think that link to what type of music is has been conclusively broken. And the link to how important technology is to musicians these days has been conclusively made. And I think that those two things we're quite proud of, you know, because these days it has changed around, you know. I think that I'm not saying we told you so, but yeah, we did tell you so. And but I like to say also that, you know, we lost the battle, but in the end we did win a war, you know, because, you know, we totally lost that battle. You know, the press kind of just dumped on us in an enormous way in 1993 and 94, and it did swamp us completely. And I think it killed a certain part of our career, you know, so we lost that battle. But I think in the end, we did win the war because nowadays we don't do interviews with anybody that's confused by our use of technology. And is we, that doesn't happen at all. I'm so glad that that's happened, you know. We were never trying to be a techno band, and we were never trying to, people thought we were trying to, I don't know, be trailblazers or do things differently in a way, you know. And we were always like, well, this isn't about doing things differently. This is just about doing things the way that you can do them and the way that they should be done, you know. And now it is the way that they are done.
That period of time when the press were very heavily negative towards you guys, how did you deal with that? I mean, it must, 93, 94 is a long, it's 2 years in the greater scheme of things. It's a small period of time, but in that time, it's a lot of bombardment coming your ways. How did you maintain your positivity throughout that?
It was difficult at times. I think a lot of the times you take solace in the fact that, you know, you can still pull a crowd, and the people love what you're doing. The fans that you have love what you're doing. That's an important part of it. I think without that, you know, because that gives you a feedback loop to what you're producing. Without that, we'd have been kind of a bit lost. And I'm just struck by how different the world is these days, you know, for musicians in that regard. You know, these days, who cares? I mean, I know we're doing things in, we're doing an interview, and we're doing kind of, you know, a music press critical appreciation thing. But in a sense, these days, it's not important. It's not important as it was anymore, you know. And I think that it was just insane how important it was back then. You know, over here in the UK, we had, you know, we had the Enemy and Melody Maker and a couple of other big sort of press things, and their viewpoint was so important. Whereas these days, I'm quite heartened to see that for a lot of musicians, it doesn't make any difference what the reviews of the paper in the paper say about your album. You know, these days, bands are much more able to control that narrative. I realize there are certain things, you know, you can't particularly navigate through. You know, it's difficult to say when things will go viral, and you can't control that all the time. You can sow the seeds on things like TikTok, but you can't control it all the time. And I think that bands being able to at least control some of their destiny in that regard is brilliant, because back then music press reactions made or broke careers and livelihoods, and that's a difficult situation to be in. We were lucky because we were insulated by a certain amount of success that we'd had. But there were other situations where bands, you know, when they got dumped on by the music press, there were bands that were literally sort of hounded out of fame. And I think that's it's just amazing to think that that actually happened, you know. I just think it's crazy.
It's completely crazy.
And don't, you know, I should say, don't get me wrong, you know, I mean, I was an avid reader of the music press, and the music press had its, I loved it, you know, get a copy of The Enemy every Wednesday or whatever, every Thursday. It was just brilliant. You know, it's part of the language of being a music fan back in those days, you know, but there was a dark side to it, and there was a dark side to the power that music press wielded back in those days. And so, yeah, for us, navigating through it was tricky at times. You have to have a lot of inbuilt faith in your own creativity, and you have to have strength. And sometimes you have to be able to draw on other things, like I said, drawing on the audience and their strength, because sometimes your own strength might not be enough to get you through it, you know? And there were times when it felt like we weren't getting through it, but at the end of the day, we're here, and about 90% of those music paper titles aren't here anymore anyway. So again, you know, we lost the battle, but you know, maybe we won the war. I don't know.
Are those vinyls I see next behind you? So for the guys
Yeah,
listening on Zoom. Okay, so that brings me to my next question. So we had vinyls, cassette, CDs. I love a CD. I love the aesthetic of holding something, the art, the visuals, the thank yous. For me, it's a thank you to you guys for all the hard work you've got. Your CDs are in my collection, just so you know. And now we've got these digital platforms. What is your perception of the way people consume music now compared to how they used to? Just on a side note, a couple of years ago, CDs had the first time in 21 years increase in sales. Last year's vinyls in the UK alone were at 5.5 million, which is the biggest sales since 1990. So those are resurging. But what are your perceptions around the whole industry where we are now?
It's a different thing, isn't it? I mean, I grew up listening to and obsessing over physical product, you know, 7-inch singles and albums and what have you. And I've still got thousands of CDs. I love physical product, and there is a relationship that a fan has with music that you get from physical product that cannot really be replicated in any other way. And I think it's weird. And you know, once the streaming revolution started, this resurgence in physical formats has come, I think, as a byproduct of streaming. And streaming gave you the ability to not have to own anything. That was the whole thing. When streaming started, it was like, well, you don't need a collection anymore, because the collection just exists, you know, on Spotify, and you can just say, well, I want to listen to James Brown, and then I want to listen to the Rolling Stones, and then I want to listen to Billie Eilish, and then I want to listen to Beethoven. And you can just go bang, bang, bang. And you didn't have to own all these things. You could just listen to anything, anywhere, anytime, which is fine. But if it was completely fine, then people would have actually got rid of everything. and we'd have never seen any physical product, and all the old physical product would have somehow just vanished. And yet, in the same way that books, still people want books, and you can get, a Kindle reader, even though there's streaming and you can access everything, people still want physical product. And also, I think that the rise of streaming has actually accelerated the need for physical product. So as streaming has become more prevalent, people need physical product even more. And I think that's because streaming has emphasized the distance between us and the music. It hasn't brought it closer. Well, it's
Yes.
kind of brought it closer because I can just bring it up on my phone, but it's brought it closer, but it feels further away sometimes. And physical product is just one of those things which brings things so close to you because it's tactile. You can hold it,
Yeah.
you.
And it's also an experience to know, okay, this month I'm going to budget for this amount and I'm going to choose the Jesus Jones, album, this album, that album, and I'm going to go to the store or order it online, open the packaging, and it's a whole experience of listening it from song one to 10:15.
Well,
Yeah.
I think that you make an incredibly valid point, because physical is about making a definite choice. It's about making a choice, and it's about committing yourself and your finances and your time to something. You're making a vow, to that piece of physical product. You're saying, look, I believe in you enough to be able to want to spend my money on you. You're saying, right, that's it. I'm committing to you. Whereas streaming is a very fickle mistress. Although we pay our $10 or our $15 a month or whatever it is, although we're actually paying some money out, streaming itself feels like a very fickle mistress because if you say, I just want to listen to the first Clash album, you can listen to 30, 40 seconds of it, and then you can go, no, nah, I'm gonna listen to something else, and back off it goes, and then
Yeah.
and then you just and then you're just you're like a butterfly, hopping from one flower to the next and
Yeah.
never settling and never staying in one place kind of long enough to do anything. And that's one of the issues I find with streaming is that I don't commit to things when I'm streaming. The amount of times you just skip, skip, skip. You're pinballing around from your playlist of one thing or another, and you can't beat, a physical album sometimes for that thing of, well, you're just going to sit there and you're going to listen to one side of an album,
Yes.
start to finish. And I think that's a powerful process.
Yes. I love your analogy of the butterfly. I think that's so cool. I'm going to keep it in my backhand. I love playing this game. My recipients don't always like it.
Okay.
So I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 20 minutes, 2 hours, 2 days, and I realize and I recognize that your answer will be different each time I ask you that this question. But once we finish this recording, if you had to push play on five songs by other artists, what would those five songs be?
What would the five songs be? I'd have Hiroshima Mon Amour by Ultravox. I would have Why Does the Rain by The Loft. I
Okay.
would have Beautiful White by The Pursuit of Happiness. I would have Beauty Dies Young by Low Gold.
Yes.
And I would have Beverly by The Flies. Those are the five. But as you say, it is a difficult one.
Yes,
And
it
if
is
you asked me
difficult.
5 minutes, there'd be
Yeah.
five totally different things. But
Yeah.
I'm quite happy with the idea that I can find five things really quickly.
Yeah.
That makes me happy.
The podcast is listened to throughout the world. As
Okay.
a final message to the listening audience, what would you like to say?
All opinions are my own strictly. I hope I haven't kind of trodden on anybody's toes with my opinions. I've always kind of been one of those people that believes in music and also believes in a belief in music. And I think if you have a belief in music, you have to have it fairly consistently, and you have to have it with strength and determination and purpose. And I remember all my journey through music taught me that you're always going to come across people who go, No, you're totally wrong. Oh, you like that? No, you're wrong. Whatever. Or they don't like your band or your views or whatever. But I think that's the glory of music, the idea that you can find something and stick to it, even if sometimes people will disagree with your choices or your views. So, yeah, I mean, I've always been quite forthright about my opinions when it comes to music. So, yeah, if they don't chime with people out there listening to this podcast, sorry, but I think that's the key thing in music. You know, if you're gonna be out there, you know, find something that you love in music and stick to it and have those beliefs. What else would I say? I would say, quite simply, I think I'd always like to say thank you to anybody that's listened to us and liked us over the years. I mean, it's been 35 years, which I quite honestly can't believe. You know, the idea that I can still be talking to somebody now. When we started in 1988, the idea that I'd be sitting here in a different part of the UK, in like a different house with a family, and I'm still doing the band, and it's 35 years later, and now there's the internet, and we're doing things on a Zoom call, and it's just, you know, that's just amazing to see how kind of life has changed and everything's kind of developed over the years, and to know that Jesus Jones as a kind of a band and a concept have kind of drifted along somehow with all those things. It's just nothing short of amazing to me. And a lot of the reason that that's happened is because, all right, we've kept the band alive, but people have kept the band alive in their hearts as well, you know? And I've never, ever got to the point where I've forgotten that or been ungrateful, you know? I've always been so thankful that people haven't forgotten about us and have allowed this project to continue, you know, without them and without their interest in what we do. There is no doubt that I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you, you know. So I'm thankful for those people out there who still keep the flame going, you know. Thanks to each and every one of them. That's the only basic thing that I should be saying at this particular point, you know, is thanks to everybody that loves us.